So last Sunday we took a look at the first two at the first of two accounts of the creation. The one that we looked at is in the what we call chapter one of Genesis. There's actually two different tellings of it in some ways, and chapter two is the second way of telling the story. And we considered how important it was, or it is, to carefully understand what is being said there and how we might need to set aside some of our expectations and presumptions and limited perspectives to actually understand what God is saying through chapter one of Genesis and through any part of His Word. I used the illustration of these drawings that were found, but when they were found, they were just trenches. And I had us imagining experts standing in those trenches, literally entrenched, trying to figure out what they were. And then not until an airplane flew over was it figured out that they were massive drawings, and they're still speculating as to how could a people who couldn't fly make drawings that can only be seen from way high up in the air. Well, Genesis and most of Scripture is a lot like that. You need to get a God's eye view or a bird's eye view. You and not be entrenched. So I put it to you last week that when we accept that Genesis 1 is not necessarily a scientific account of how God created, when we accept that, it has room to gain meaning at other levels for us. When we read it in an open, eager way, listening and looking for signals of what was important to its author, we then began to notice a huge emphasis on God's action. I tried to represent that on the screen. God said, God made, God saw. It's all God acting. And it was so. So there's a kind of a definiteness about it that we saw. And God saw that it was good. There was a goodness about it. In the end, I'm hoping you saw that the account of creation was what we might refer to today as an evangelistic invitation to those who worshiped things. Things that this one God of Israel had made. It was then an invitation to consider there was a higher power behind all that had been made. So the Bible starts right off telling mankind of the powerful, faultless action of God in cosmic and human history. Today, I'd like to take a look together at a small portion of that initial creation account, namely the last part where we are told God created human beings, verses 26 to 28 of chapter 1, and then also pick up the main point of the first verses of chapter 2. I might repeat this analogy. I don't know if you've ever heard it before, but you can nod your head if you know the story of how we got chapters and verses in the Bible. Do you know that story? And how sometimes they don't really line up with what the Bible is saying, the breaks aren't at the right places. Well, the story is that one of the first people to start translating from the Latin into more readable languages, and decided to break it down into chapters and verses so that people could find places more easily. But he did all this on horseback after a long day riding home. And so every once in a while he kind of missed somewhere where it would have been better to put the chapter break in a different place. And so that's in some ways what might have happened here. So let's read that. We'll begin back at verse 26. Then God said, this breaks then a pattern of the parts before. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. That's a little poem. So God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. And you'll notice that that's a repetition. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. My three kids who are vegetarians quote this passage. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Then chapter 2 begins. So the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. And so that's as far as we'll read this morning. Dear people, created by God for a purpose. When we read in verses 26 to 28 of chapter 1 of Genesis, what we read there is the crowning moment of God's creative actions to set our world in motion, the world that we know. This is the first description of the creation of humankind. A second one follows in chapter 2. I don't think we're going to go to that one next Sunday. The writer shows that it's the pinnacle moment of the creation account, the highlight. And he does that by the way the passage has been shaped or structured. And if you have opportunity to learn the Hebrew language and how it works, you have opportunity to learn the beauty of that kind of structure, the structure of the verse even having and carrying some of the meaning. For instance, one structural clue, if you start counting the times that God speaks in that chapter, then you will notice that on this particular day, as we call it, God speaks four times. So that's more than on any other day. So it's an extra heavy work day for God, so to speak. And that makes it stand out. He speaks twice to create, and a third time to bless it, specifically, and then a fourth to give the plants as food. That's twice more than in any other creation sequence of events, or what we have come to call day. So it was a significant day's work, we might say. It stands out from the rest. And that's one of the keys to knowing it's important. Some other clear and fairly obvious things indicating this is a topping creation off is that people are the last thing God creates. He's been in a process of forming and filling. Hopefully those of you who were here last Sunday won't forget to notice those two words in verse 2 all the time. Of bringing order out of chaos. And once that's done, he makes people. And only people, nothing else, in his image, in his likeness, to reflect and represent God in the cosmos. And then he gives them the responsibility for the rest of what he has made. He delegates his power to them. In Jesus' words that we heard earlier, where he said, "All authority has been given to me," he's passing that authority again to his disciples, and we carry that authority now as well, the salvation authority. But here, humankind was given authority over creation, the authority of stewardship and care. And then after giving over all that he had created to the care of the people, God rests. So that's a pretty good indication that humankind or people completed the creative process. Related to that idea, if you want to think about this some more, of God speaking things into being as the work that God did, it's interesting to note that God does not even speak on the seventh day. Now, we don't have to turn that into a legalistic rule that we can't talk on the Sabbath, but it's just significant that he doesn't speak. The day is set apart as blessed, but it's not spoken by God. It's his action that makes it blessed. So the sixth day is a significant day. The day God's work is completed and crowned by the creation of humankind. And that completedness is indicated by the detail the author goes into and by the short poem, which is in verse 27 in our Bibles. And there are other clues which are in the original language. God spoke and it was so, and it was very good after the work. And so God was able to rest and joy and appreciate what had been made. So now I want to back up to a couple other points that help you understand how it's an evangelistic document. Because I only touched on that last Sunday. Moses, because of his education and access to knowledge, his unique way of being raised, was very well qualified to be the one God inspired to put his experiences and knowledge into writing. He knew enough to write a telling of the creation story or creation account that directly and specifically counters those of many of the people around him in that day, the Egyptians and the Babylonians, for instance. It's an alternative, better accounting, written by someone who knew how the peoples thought and what they believed. Remember, when we looked at this before, I mentioned, well, I'll skip that because I'm going to re-repeat it, so I won't do that again. So I want to point out five areas in which the Genesis 1 account counters the religious beliefs of other nations around Israel. And the fifth one that I get to will bring us back to our passage for today. First of all, in the beliefs of many peoples of that day, dragons or sea monsters are actually rivals to the gods who must be conquered by the gods, and the gods with a small g, the gods that they believed in. So there's this rivalry between the dragons and their gods are supposed to control these dragons or sea monsters. In Genesis 1, so if you think of that perspective, then in Genesis 1:21, the great creatures of the sea, these dragons, are just listed as another of the aquatic animals created by God. There's no spiritual meaning given to them in that same way. No, they're just creatures that God made. The second one is that in connection with their belief of many peoples that the gods controlled fertility and especially the rains which were needed for things to grow, the beliefs of these other peoples included explanations of the difficult time the gods had in managing the upper waters, remember the ones that were above the sky, and the ones that are in the ground below the earth. And so, to such people, floods would not be the result of high snowfall, high snowpack in the winter, but they would be because the gods had somehow failed, because they were fallible, to control the lower waters. And so the waters would rise, the waters under the earth. Or they'd believe that the gods were angry at them as the people, and had released the waters on purpose to punish them and to teach them. So in the face of beliefs like that, along comes Moses, who tells of a God who, by a few words, sorts the various waters into their proper places and is done with them. What a different God this is. People hearing this account would have room to think. And the third one is this worshiping of the sun and the moon and the rivers and the animals and things like that, which many people did. And Moses makes it clear that these objects were created by his God. And created by his God are given functions that suit that God's plan. They are not gods in themselves. So Moses paints a pretty big and powerful God here that would give people room to go, whoa, I've placed my worship too low. There's a God behind all of this. And the fourth one is that many of the gods of the nations around Israel had this habit of speaking magic phrases. I didn't have time to look up Harry Potter magic phrases so the kids could follow this, so I'll use magic phrases that I remember from my childhood, or what we call incantations. Does anybody have a Harry Potter incantation that just comes to them just like that? Okay, just checking. Or a hobbit one. Their gods would say words like abracadabra or hocus pocus or open sesame are the ones I grew up with. And those magic phrases would make things happen. But Moses' God simply speaks. And speaks simply. He says, be, and things are. No mystery, no magic in how the words were said or what words were used. This God was so powerful that he simply spoke and things happened, and he spoke clearly. So hopefully you're getting a sense from those four of what's being accomplished in Genesis 1 here for the people around Israel. You're beginning to hear how it was intended to be heard. And now the fifth example. And I'll spend a little bit more time on this one. This has to do with the role of people in creation. Around the time this was likely written, the Babylonian explanation of the world and how it came into being put people into the world as an afterthought by the gods. So the gods were already using the world as their playground and decided that they needed people in it as an afterthought. People were there to do the work and to provide the gods with food. In that way, it is that way still for many religious systems, which make people the puppets or slaves of the gods. And so people would harvest their crops and give sacrificial portions to feed the gods in order to keep them happy so they would keep sending good weather. It was kind of a bribery system. And it's true that often God's own people would turn God, their interactions with God, into that same kind of bribery. And so that's a dangerous thing that we should watch out for. God doesn't take bribes, doesn't need them. Moses tells a completely different story. In his account, people are created as the main goal of God in creation, as the item that capped it all off, that completed it. Not only are they the crowning achievement instead of an afterthought, but the God of Genesis puts them in it to image him, to represent him. Not so much to appease him as a god like the gods of the other religions required. And then to top even that, he gives them their food. See how different that is? There's no sense of being a slave to God at all in that. This is a truly different God. A one-of-a-kind God. A unique God, a caring, serving God. And to make the difference even more obvious, this God makes people who are to be in charge of what he has made. He says, it's yours. He makes them trusted stewards, not slaves. And here I am hoping that some of you can tie this back in your own minds to the parable of the lost son that we looked at. What did the older son rant about? All these years I've slaved for you. God the Father does not look for slaves in that way. The gods of other religions do. And who would be more likely to be a good trusted steward of the Father's estate than the younger son who had wandered away and who had been received back in love? Was willing to be a slave, but it wasn't necessary. He was adopted back into the family. See? So, trusted stewards are a different thing than slaves. So the people that Moses' God creates are given very specific orders to rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. And then that's repeated. And again, in the way that Hebrew language works, I'll give you a longer explanation in another sermon, repetition often frames a piece that's more important. Just like we put picture frames around a picture, in Hebrew writing, there are phrases that can be used to frame a particular thing that is being said in a sense that it's supposed to stand out. It's like highlighting. Repetition highlights, but this does it as well. And that poem, "So God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created them, male and female he created them," is in bold print, so to speak. So goes Moses' explanation of why God put people on the planet. And we call it our cultural mandate in the Reformed branch of Christianity, and there could be a series of sermons on what all those things mean. But my point this morning is to show you again, a little more clearly, how Moses, in how he was inspired to write this all down, was making a case for a God who was radically different than all the gods of the other religious systems of that day. This God gave people a place of honor and great responsibility on earth. And they were made to be a reflection of God's likeness, to represent God's grace and mercy and glory as they ruled or governed the earth. They were to take charge and to bring God glory in how they did that. This is why in the Reformed branch of Christianity we're very big on education. Because to be good stewards, we need to understand the thing that we're stewarding. God even gives Adam the job of giving things names. Education is really all about learning to give things names. Although sometimes we think that if we can give something a name, we've conquered it in some ways too, but that's not always the case. So we're to learn, we're to become educated about this world we are stewards of in God's place. But there's a problem. Adam and Eve, those first two people made to image God, distorted the job they were given by choosing to disobey. And so the job of mastering the world and taking charge of it for God's sake and God's glory is distorted and it's misused and misdirected. And we tend to honor things that have been created more than the God who created them. We don't worship wooden idols so much as people used to, but we do have hero idols. We do have performer idols. We do idolize ideologies and other things. We are materialist in our idolatry often. So we have other ways that we distort that. And so since Adam and Eve were evicted from God's presence in the garden and the honor of a close walk with God, we all have lived a disordered life, presenting blurred and distorted images of our Creator and not doing a very good job of being stewards of His creation or even of our own lives. But people of God, there's good news. Even there, we don't have to despair in that. We can continue to learn about this world and about God. And when we continue to learn, we learn about this amazingly ordered world. And we learn God did not give up on it either, but loved it so much that He sent His own Son to take away the punishment that we deserved for continuing the wrong choices of Adam and Eve. God's own Son gave us freedom from sin debt to God and gave us a blueprint for how to become restored images of God, how to restore that relationship. He opened the gate to that relationship being made anew. Do you eagerly and earnestly want to be a clearer image of God than you have been? Learn. Learn about this world and about God's Word. Look in the mirror of His Word and see what His Son did for you. He came and He died. He suffered. He struggled. He was misunderstood. He died at the hands of the people He came to address. And then He was raised. But in His death, He took away the barriers between us and God so that the relationship we heard about earlier could be restored by simple faith in what Jesus has done. No mystical statements need to be made, no abracadabras, simple faith in what Jesus did for us. And then we can be led by the Spirit and by the Christian community on a journey of growing to be like that Jesus, as we have prayed and hope for Asher to begin. And One day, every day, will be the seventh day. And we who believe in God's redeeming work through His Son will also be fully at rest, having eternal rest and relationship with God the Father and Creator. What a wonderful day that will be. And God's people said, Amen.